Lots going on in Washington for a Monday in August. President Obama unveiling new rules for power plant emissions. They're being called the biggest step that any single president has made to curb carbon pollution.
Also, abortion rights supporters and foes are lining up in the Senate, ready to vote later today on a measure to cut federal funding to Planned Parenthood in response to those secretly recorded videos that surfaced showing employees talking about providing fetal parts for research. Now, this has become a hot issue in the presidential campaign. Here's Kentucky Senator Rand Paul, who filed the bill on CNN yesterday.
I think most Americans don't want their tax dollars going to this. So I think when something is so morally repugnant to so many people, why should tax dollars go to this? We have 9,000 community health centers that do everything that Planned Parenthood does, but they don't get into abortion. So it'd be much less emotional for everyone if we just funded community health centers and didn't fund Planned Parenthood.
This measure is not expected to pass, but it's part of a larger battle over abortion. Jennifer Ludden of NPR's National Desk has been covering all of this. And Jennifer, start with where this is going, because as we just said, this bill is not expected to pass. So is today's vote the end of this debate?
For sure not, I would say. You know, some are threatening to veto a spending bill later this year over this, you know, with putting out the prospect of another government shutdown. As we just heard, big issue for the Republican presidential candidates. You know, 5 years ago, Congress also tried to defund Planned Parenthood. So it's not like this is a new issue.
Right.
It's just a new opportunity to push for it.
Well, and start with what's true. The critics say that Planned Parenthood was making money off these sales, and that's illegal. Planned Parenthood said the tapes were edited, that what they do is legal and life-saving. We're hearing from researchers who use the tissue. And there was once bipartisan support for this research.
Right. Once again, an old issue comes back. We've had a series of bipartisan commissions in the U.S. since the 1970s research this, because a lot of people do, you know, have concerns, find it very disturbing what happens, you know, with after a fetus is aborted. And so people have looked into this. And every time when they weigh the ethical concerns, they have decided that the benefit to society outweighs that. We've had, you know, vaccines starting with polio derived from fetal parts research. And there's a lot of research going on today on all kinds of medical issues. You know, Planned Parenthood itself has said, well, let's have another commission and let's look at this.
Right. Well, we just heard Senator Paul say or ask, why should tax dollars go to this? Do they? You know, first of all, Planned Parenthood says only a fraction of its work involves abortions. We've heard perhaps as low as 3%. And isn't federal money for abortions banned?
Right. And let me just hit two things. So on both issues,
yeah,
the National Institutes of Health spends about $76 million a year for fetal tissue research. Then the other issue that Rand Paul was talking about on abortion, that is already banned. There's a ban on spending federal money on abortion already. So what supporters say is, well, you know, we cut off money to Planned Parenthood. They're going to shrink their budget. They logically would do fewer abortions. Planned Parenthood says, no, if you cut our funding, that money is going to come from all our other services, the bulk of what we provide, which includes, you know, screening for cancer, tests and screening for sexually transmitted diseases, and birth control, you know, which they say, ironically, if you cut money for that, in the end, you're going to end up having to need more women will need abortions.
Yeah. Well, Congress isn't the only entity looking to cut funding for Planned Parenthood. States already have. Remind us what's happened there.
Right. Starting in 2011, the last time this came up in Congress, we've had a handful of states actually defund Planned Parenthood in their states. And now we're just starting to get a lot of studies coming out looking at that. A lot of the focus has been on Texas. It's so big. A study out in May found that, you know, only about half the number of women are being served at family planning clinics since, you know, from before the cuts, and that about a quarter of all family planning clinics in Texas have closed since the state cut funding for Planned Parenthood. And the idea that, you know, Rand Paul says there's all these other clinics that can take these women, it's not so easy, according to reproductive rights groups. A lot of Planned Parenthood clinics particularly are in very rural areas. In some places, they say that the only clinic serving that area ends up shut down. And also a lot of the patients we're talking about have very low income, and the money comes through Medicaid. You know, some doctors don't want to accept those patients, and the states had to work hard to convince more of them to do so, to keep up the services.
Yeah. Jennifer London of NPR's National Desk, who's been following the debate. There's going to be a vote today in the Senate. Jennifer London, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Well, now to some sweeping new environmental rules that could affect what energy we use and how we generate it. Today, President Obama announcing new EPA regulations to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from power plants. They are the first such federal limits on carbon emissions, and the impact is expected to reach far and wide, as are the legal challenges. NPR's Jeff Brady is covering this, and he joins us now. Jeff, welcome.
Thank you.
First, explain these new rules. How do they work?
Well, the White House calls this its Clean Power Plan. And for the first time ever, the feds are going to set limits on how much carbon pollution can be emitted from power plants. Carbon dioxide is among the greenhouse gases that contributes to climate change. And this plan would reduce carbon emissions from power plants by 32% by 2030. And it's a little confusing, but that's set on a baseline of what those carbon emissions were in 2005. Mm. So from 2005 to 2030, 32% less carbon emissions from power plants. And that 32% reduction, it's a more ambitious goal than what the EPA was proposing when it put a draft plan out last summer. The kinds of plants most affected would be coal-fired power plants, because those are the ones putting out the most carbon pollution. And states will have a little bit of flexibility here in figuring out how to meet those goals. And under this new rule, one of the big changes is they'll get 2 more years to comply with the regulations.
We got a little sneak peek over the weekend. The White House released a video on Facebook, President Obama explaining why he's doing this. Let's listen.
Climate change is not a problem for another generation, not anymore. That's why on Monday, my administration will release the final version of America's Clean Power Plan, the biggest, most important step we've ever taken to combat climate change.
Jeff, you said this plan is more ambitious than past ones. What's the president trying to accomplish here politically?
You know, he's trying to follow up on what were his earlier efforts to get a cap-and-trade program passed in Congress. Cap-and-trade means that you place a cap on greenhouse gas emissions and then allow people to trade it, and that encourages folks to invest in sort of greener alternatives for generating electricity. Congress didn't act on that proposal, so the administration is relying on the Clean Air Act for the authority to regulate carbon pollution from power plants. So really, he's trying to use the tools he has to accomplish his goals, which one of them is to address climate change. And there's a sense that this will also give him some more credibility when he goes to Paris later this year, and that he's going there for the UN climate conference. Hopefully, I think the administration believes that with something like this in hand, they can go and get other nations to sign on to an agreement.
Well, as you said, cap and trade has not gone over well. Republicans call it cap and tax. But this would be something kind of like a cap and trade system, right? How would that work?
Well, it could be. There's not really anything in there that says, you know, you must put a cap and trade program in place. EPA Administrator Gina McCarthy pointed this out specifically because it's just not in that plan. But because she likes to point out that there is flexibility for the states to act and to meet these goals. And so you could imagine a scenario where a state or group of states gets together and creates their own cap and trade program. But the fact that it's not one required by the federal government is one that she likes to point out is not in the Clean Power Plan.
Right. But it's not as if that is making it much more palatable for some places. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, of course, a huge coal state, calling on governors to refuse to comply with these regulations. More than a dozen states are said to be preparing legal challenges. Is this a prolonged legal battle, like one we haven't seen since the Affordable Care Act?
Yep, and I think the Affordable Care Act is probably a good analogy. We're looking for a couple of years of legal battles that are going to be drawn out, and you're going to hear lots and lots of news stories about how that's going to play out. even before the plan was made final, because there was a draft plan a year ago, and this is the final. Some states, like the Attorney General in West Virginia, was saying that he was going to challenge the plan.
Right.
And today we're also seeing that some folks in the coal industry are saying they're going to challenge the plan. A company called Murray Energy put out a press release saying that they were filing 5 lawsuits.
And briefly, Jeff, what does this mean for 2016, the presidential race?
Oh, I think definitely this is going to be a big issue, especially in some of these coal states. And you're going to hear a lot about the Clean Power Plan and whether we should be addressing climate change in this way or another way.
All right.
So expect to hear a lot about that.
Well, we'll keep checking in with you as this fight, really, it's probably going to be a fight, continues. NPR's Jeff Brady, thanks very much.
Thank you.
14 presidential hopefuls are expected to participate in a candidates forum tonight in New Hampshire. Donald Trump, by the way, will not be there. But the event could give voters an early look at the Republican crowded field. And it's a good bet that their views will be more conservative than when the first presidential primary was held in the Granite State 100 years ago. New Hampshire Republicans today are far more socially progressive than their fellow Republican kin. So what's the role of the New Hampshire GOP primary these days? Asma Khalid from Here and Now contributor WBUR reports.
When Republican candidates are not in New Hampshire, they're usually eager to show off their conservative street cred. Here's Ted Cruz, Jeb Bush, and Marco Rubio at a meeting of the Conservative Faith and Freedom Coalition in Washington, D.C.
When I was the Solicitor General of Texas, I was proud to defend the Ten Commandments monument on the state capitol grounds.
We should not push aside those that do believe in traditional marriage. I, for one, believe it's important, and I think
And you cannot have strong families with a government that strong-arms parents and our faith.
But when Republican presidential candidates swing through New Hampshire, social issues are on the back burner. Take Carly Fiorina. In Iowa, she's trying to make abortion a major campaign issue. But at a recent campaign stop in New Hampshire, she only mentioned abortion after a voter directly asked her about it. That voter was Andrea Alexander, and she says a candidate's abortion position is a litmus test for many of her friends.
The Republicans have to nail that. If you're anti-Roe v. Wade, goodbye.
Alexander personally disagrees with Fiorina's opposition to abortion rights, but she says she'll still vote for Fiorina.
She's my new Mitt Romney. It's about the economy, stupid.
And Alexander's attitude sort of explains New Hampshire GOP politics.
Republicans here aren't going to be upset if a candidate has a position on either gay marriage or abortion that is out of step with theirs. They just don't want to hear him talk about it.
University of New Hampshire political scientist Andy Smith.
They're more than happy to have the candidate hold whatever position they feel is important, but just don't try to get me to change my mind and make me vote for you because of that position.
Polls suggest New Hampshire is second only to Vermont in the least religious state category. And nearly half of New Hampshire's Republican primary voters approve of same-sex marriage, not to mention they're also more supportive of abortion rights than the country as a whole. Smith says that creates tension. And so Republican candidates steer clear of social issues on the New Hampshire campaign trail.
Great example of that. Ben Carson was here. And Carson got his political start largely being involved in evangelical groups. The National Prayer Breakfast, he gave a big speech, and that kind of put him on the national stage. Very popular among social conservative groups within the Republican Party. He came and talked and didn't talk once about abortion.
Why talk about it? It's a law and it's a done deal and it's not going to get repealed.
That's Doug Scammon's attitude on abortion. Scammon is a veteran state lawmaker, sort of like GOP royalty in the Granite State.
New Hampshire is a place that looks at people, how do we think they're going to govern, and not so much how they're going to tell us how we live our lives.
Andy Smith, the political scientist from UNH, points out that for a good chunk of the 20th century, New England, and New Hampshire in particular, was Republican territory.
That's not that the voters in New Hampshire have changed. It's really that the Republican Party has changed a lot.
But even though the GOP has shifted away from New England, New Hampshire still has a big impact on picking the GOP nominee. Smith explains it this way.
Because it's early in the process, and because it has high turnout, after New Hampshire, the moderate wing of the party is winnowed down to one candidate, typically.
And then, Smith says, by the time you get to South Carolina,
it's usually a battle between that one person who's the moderate mainstream candidate versus maybe two social conservatives and a couple of other social conservatives who aren't really major candidates, but they're still in there because they're fighting on issue positions.
Chris Galdieri, a politics professor at St. Anselm's College in Manchester, says the New Hampshire primary remains important because it's not just about New Hampshire. It's a microcosm of a general election.
A lot of Republicans are going to be paying attention to not just who says the right things, but who do I think has the best chance of getting elected.
And that means this old-fashioned New Hampshire strain of GOP politics carries more weight than you would expect in the modern Republican Party. For Here and Now, I'm Asma Khalid.
So, as we heard, Donald Trump will not be at the Republican candidate forum tonight in New Hampshire, but he seems to be everywhere else, including perhaps wandering through Carlos Lozada's dreams. The Washington Post nonfiction book critic binge-read 8 of Trump's 17 books last week, memoirs and business advice books, in total more than 2,200 pages of Trump. Carlos, give us the headline.
Well, you know, I thought that the experience of book writing would maybe temper Donald Trump a little bit, would render him more reflective, more thoughtful. But what I realized is that it doesn't dilute him at all. It sort of concentrates him. It makes him Trumpier. So he goes after anyone who's ever wronged him. He's constantly boasting about how everything he owns, everything he touches is the best, the biggest, the most beautiful. And pretty much everyone in the world is divided into either class acts or total losers.
Well, that may not surprise people who follow Donald Trump. That is how he presents himself in real life. But what do we learn about him? Start with his business dealings, because you write, you encountered a world where bragging is breathing, insulting is talking, vengefulness and insecurity erupt at random. But you have books like The Art of the Deal, 1987. What do we learn, if anything, about Donald Trump, businessman?
You know, one thing that's interesting, early in his career, before he was such a brand name, before he was so well known as a real estate developer, he had to convince potential partners and companies that he was really worth their time. So he would very purposely sort of play to people's fantasies and engage in what he called truthful hyperbole. So, for instance, he's trying to convince the board of directors of a company that a construction site he's working on where he's building a hotel is much further along than it really is. So when they're going to go visit, he, for example, will have the construction crew just go back and forth, digging holes, refilling them, digging them again, to make it seem like this illusion of a very active site. And of course, they bought it. His whole career, he talks about how the aura that you develop around yourself is as important as the reality. He says it's an innocent form of exaggeration.
Well, you know, it's funny. The people who are polled who say they like Donald Trump, what they do like about him is his bluster and his sense of confidence. But you read something like that and you wonder, do you want a president who would seem more like the Wizard of Oz? You know, pay no attention to the man behind the curtain.
You know, what's interesting, because people do say that they relate to him in some way. One thing I found interesting is how sort of isolated he is from the rest of the world. Presidents often complain about being trapped in a bubble, right? How they can't connect to ordinary people. In Trump's case, he seems to have erected that bubble very deliberately. He talks about how he's worked in the same building where he lives. Even his show was shot in the same building where he spends most of his time. When he's not there, when he's outside, he's in a limo or a jet or a helicopter. And he says the only time he's really outside a lot is when he's at a golf course. So it is a pretty isolated existence that doesn't seem terribly relatable.
Well, does it seem presidential?
Well, you know, he is presidential in some ways, maybe not in the ways that people would prefer. He's incredibly reluctant to admit mistakes. He's very confrontational with the news media, and he comes off in his business dealings as a serious micromanager. He says he would bring that to the presidency as well. In one of his books, he talks about how if he became president, he would appoint himself as the U.S. trade representative and personally negotiate all the trade deals with the world. So in that case, you know, is that presidential? Maybe for some who have been accused of trying to meddle too much and not be able to deal with the layers that come with the job.
What do you think? You're a reviewer. not a psychologist, but what do you think?
If
people were to read these books, would the people who like him even more when he trashes everyone? For instance, a former Miss Universe for gaining weight. He meets a one-star general and asks, how come you're only a one-star? He calls the Rolling Stones a bunch of major jerks. Will they like that even more? Or when it's laid out in print, will it maybe dull the attraction?
I suspect that it will, as with many of these things, tend to reinforce people's feelings. I've gotten a lot of reaction to the piece I wrote in the Post that appeared this Sunday. And people who love Trump continue loving Trump and find things in these writings that reinforce their beliefs. People who are wary of Donald Trump read what I have written and say, oh, my God, how could this guy possibly be at the top of the GOP field? So I suspect it'll play to people's pre-existing biases.
But you say that while the books brought out in you revulsion, amusement, and confusion, there was also respect. Respect for what?
Well, he's very dedicated to his work. Certainly early in his career, this is a guy who worked round the clock and was very, very devoted to what he was doing. He's clearly had success in this field. He's found ways to extend the brand, whether into television and certainly into books. So that definitely, I think, deserves some respect.
Well, and if they don't want to wade through all eight books, we'll link them to your article. Carlos Lozada, nonfiction book critic for The Washington Post, thank you.
Thank you very much.
A terrible tragedy in baseball this weekend, a player's and a parent's nightmare. A young adult batter accidentally hit a 9-year-old, Kaiser Carlisle, in a practice swing on Saturday. Kaiser died yesterday. He was the beloved bat boy of the Liberal BJs of Liberal Kansas, a team in the National Congress League. This was during their World Series. Bob Lutz of the Wichita Eagle is here. And Bob, just this is terrible, but help us understand. What was this game?
Well, this is a World Series. It's National Baseball Congress. It's the 81st year of this tournament. It's college players from all around the country playing for their summer teams, and some of the best of those teams gather here in Wichita every summer and play a tournament.
So these are big, strong adults, and you have a 9-year-old bat boy, Kaiser Carlisle, who we understand loved baseball, and this is probably exactly where he wanted to be with the big guys.
Yeah, you know, he's just a kid that grew up in Liberal. He's related to the founders of this team. The Carlisle name in Liberal is a household name, and been involved with the BJ since their inception 60 years ago. So yeah. It's just such a sad thing, because you're right, he was doing what he loved. He loved being around this team. This team, from what I'm told, absolutely adored this 9-year-old kid, and you can imagine the shock and heartbreak that goes with something like this.
Well, for people who haven't been around baseball and kids, it's a thing you say from day one, watch before you swing, or watch for people swinging, because that bat, you know. And that may make a lot of people wonder how these players continued when Kaiser was injured that day, Saturday. They decided he would have wanted them to continue. Then they played again on Sunday and heard he died. And Kaiser Carlisle's parents and the parents of the batter who accidentally struck him were both there.
Yeah, and I think that's a big reason why this team has decided to move ahead and to continue to play, because they believe, and with the blessing of the parents of Kaiser, that this is something he would have wanted them to do. He would have wanted to be part of a winning team and to try to win this tournament.
What does the batter say? Who, you know, an accident, swinging a bat. I mean, how is he going out there? How's that working?
Well, he didn't play last night, and for obvious reasons, we're not releasing the name of the player. But you can imagine how horrific this must be for him, and I think it's important that while we certainly remember Kaiser and in our hopes and prayers, that we also devote some of that to this young man who was involved in this accident, and that's what it was. It was just a terrible, awful accident.
And any talk there of not having little kids be bad
boys?
Well,
you know, it's so soon after that the 9-year-old age limit for bat boys could be increased. I mean, there's been some banter on social media about moving that up to 11 or 13 or I think it's way too soon to talk about what may change in terms of Bat Boys, but I think it's a time to reflect and to remember this young man who, by all accounts, was just a great kid.
And Kaiser Carlisle, one of the big attractions of the team, we understand, because he was not just nine, but he was also small and used to get one of the biggest ovations when the team was announced. So a lot of sadness there in Kansas. Bob Lutz of the Wichita Eagle, thank you.
Thank you.
10 years ago this month, Hurricane Katrina tore through New Orleans. More than 1,000 died. 250,000 more fled homes that were damaged or destroyed in the devastating floods. A lot has changed in the past decade, and Allison Plyer has been tracking it. She's chief demographer at the Data Center, a group that has just come out with a new report to mark the city's progress 10 years on. And Allison, how is the recovery going?
Well, I think no one would have guessed how well the city is doing 10 years later. We have, depending on how you measure it, around 80% of the population we did before the storm. The metro area, which also was damaged, has about 93% of the population it did before the storm. Our economy is doing really well, actually better than before the storm on many measures in terms of job growth and entrepreneurship and many other indicators.
Yeah, and we'll get to that in a moment, but I want to talk about the people that left. You mentioned the population is recovering, but still 100,000 people fewer live there today than they did before the storm hit. What do we know about who left and actually who came back?
What we can do is just look at the raw numbers, and we have 97,000 fewer African Americans in the city and 9,000 fewer whites and about 6,000 more Hispanics and then about 3,000 more Asians and others. So, the demographic shift has definitely been significant. Even with that, before the storm, the city was 66% African American, and it's still 60% African American. So, definitely a still majority minority city, and a lot of folks have returned, although certainly not everyone has returned.
And the suburbs have become more diverse. More Latinos moved to the suburb, for instance.
Yeah, so that's an interesting phenomenon demographers call hurricane chasers, where you have, single Latino men who are sort of a very mobile labor force, and they'll go from one place to the other, oftentimes in Florida, following a disaster to help rebuild. You know, our disaster was so massive that there was rebuilding going on for years. And so after several years, a lot of those single men settled down, brought their families here, and now we see an increase of Latinos, particularly in the suburbs, almost doubling in the last 10 years.
At the same time, not everybody is enjoying this recovery in the same way. Looking at your report, I see that white residents of New Orleans are, in fact, doing better than they were before the storm. But if you're an African American who lives in New Orleans, you're actually doing much worse than before Katrina hit. What's driving that?
Right. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We know from the disaster literature that a couple of things. We know that whatever the trends were before the disaster tend to get accelerated after the disaster. And also folks who were doing okay or doing well actually benefit from all the new infrastructure. But folks who were poor or even had poor health, it's really hard for them to recover. The shock is often too much. And so, what we're seeing is growing income inequality, as many of our white households are doing much better, but black households are not. We see employment rates for black men are virtually the same that they were before the storm, whereas for white men, they're much better. And it's interesting, down here, if you talk to folks, it's almost like a tale of two cities, and it often splits on racial lines. So you'll talk to white folks and they'll say, wow, the city's doing much better, never been better. All these great things are happening, entrepreneurship, the economy's great, our wages are up, et cetera, et cetera. And you talk with black folks and more often than not, they'll say things are much worse. A lot of our neighbors aren't here. It's been such a struggle to rebuild. I don't even have some of the business networks I used to have. And so, I think that, the numbers that we've put out are really to help leaders and business leaders and elected leaders understand that not everybody is doing well, and that if we want to be successful in the future and resilient to the shocks that we certainly will feel going forward, we need to, reduce our poverty rates, make sure more people are benefiting from the economic economic strength that we're starting to experience.
The numbers that you have put out show actually some encouraging signs. You've got more bike paths in New Orleans. You have cleaner air. This was fascinating. Entrepreneurship since the storm is way up, 64% higher than the national average in New Orleans. Who are they?
Well, there's a lot of folks who have gotten engaged in our entrepreneurship boom here. There are a lot of folks who really wanted to help the city recover, and some of them actually came here and started their businesses as a way to help their cities, the city recover. One example is a Receivables Exchange is a company that started here and has actually gone public, and they started here specifically because they wanted to bring their economic clout to this city. But it's done really, really well. And then there are just a myriad of other entrepreneurs. There are folks we have a lot of social entrepreneurs who are coming up with innovations for schools or for water management or for blighted properties. We have techie entrepreneurs, and a lot of them, as I said, are wanted to help the city rebuild and or wanted to help innovate in new important ways to help with some of our social problems.
I'm talking with Allison Plyer. She's chief demographer at the Data Center in New Orleans. The group just came out with a new report that tracks how New Orleans has recovered since Hurricane Katrina 10 years ago. And Allison, I've been talking to you as a demographer, asking you questions about numbers, but you're also a person who lives in the city, who was in New Orleans during the storm. And I just wondered how your own recovery is going.
My house did flood, and I got about a foot and a half of water in the house. You know, a lot of people got like 15 feet of water, and that stood for 3 weeks. And so mine wasn't nearly that bad. But if you get a foot of water in your house, that means you're going to have to gut the whole thing and rewire, and nearly everything is destroyed. And, you know, when I came back to the city in early October 2005 and tried to start rebuilding, there was only, you know, one Home Depot open for 50 miles. Wow. And it was only open from like 10 to 3. And I mean, it was incredibly difficult to try to accomplish that. And it quickly became clear to me that it was better to just move elsewhere within the city and sell my house. Hmm. So I live in a very convenient little condo on the high ground and on the second floor, and hope never to go through that again. And have you know, that's really allowed me to keep doing the work that I do to help bring all this important information to stakeholders around the country who want to know how New Orleans is doing.
And when you look at your city, you know, put the numbers aside again for a minute, and just what do you see? You know, that's so different to you 10 years later.
It's, you know, it's amazing. I mean, I think, you know, if you go to the French Quarter, as many tourists do, it looks essentially the same. And then if you go outside the French Quarter, you start to see, you know, there's more and more investment. And so the Warehouse District, which is next to the French Quarter, which was you know, just had a few condos being developed, now has gone from like 1,000 housing units to 3,000 housing units. Lots of neighborhoods are seeing, you know, some level of gentrification. There's a lot more sort of energy in the downtown area. And then, you know, there are a lot of the neighborhoods that we had 50 neighborhoods out of 72 that flooded. 15 of them were poor. A lot of folks talk about the Lower Ninth Ward, but that was really only one of 15 poor neighborhoods that flooded. Mm. And so all those neighborhoods, you know, have struggled a lot to rebuild. And so you can go and see, you know, areas where there's still a lot of blight and abandonment, and folks are still working to recover. So it's an interesting city. You know, I mean, I think we've worked incredibly hard to preserve our history and our culture. We have, you know, we still have obviously Mardi Gras and second lines and jazz and all kinds of amazing aspects to our culture that are really rooted certainly in the African-American population, and they're still very much going on. And it's a very – it's an interesting combination of sort of preservation and also, you know, innovation. And I think it's making for sort of a new New Orleans, which hopefully preserves all the good and at the same time makes things better than they were before.
Allison Plyer is chief demographer at the Data Center in New Orleans. Allison, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And we'll have much more Katrina coverage. Later this month, I'll be spending some time in New Orleans tracking how the storm and the floods still haunt the city, but also, as we heard Allison Plyer say there, how the city has done a great deal of healing in the past 10 years. If you have a Katrina recovery story that you'd like to share with us, please do, hereandnow.org. So mostly lost amid the debate over highway funding, Planned Parenthood, climate change, and frankly Donald Trump's antics, was the failure to renew a relatively unknown piece of the federal government that helps promote American businesses abroad, the Export-Import Bank. And Fortune 500 companies and small businesses are fuming because House lawmakers left for the summer recess without passing a bill that would have reauthorized the bank's charter. Randy Barcelo is a customer of the Export-Import Bank. He runs a lumber export company called BCH Trading. He joins us from Hot Springs, Arkansas. Randy, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Peter.
Sure. So tell me about your company. What kind of work do you do?
Well, BCH Trading, we are lumber exporters. Primarily, our customers are in Europe, the Middle East, and the Far East. And what we do is sell southern pine lumber and hardwood lumber, all from U.S. manufacturers. You know, if you were traveling overseas in Europe or wherever, you would see my lumber typically at manufacturers of some type, be it door manufacturers. And then some are just what we'd consider a lumber yard or a lumber importer, they call them there, that supply, you know, the local trades in those various countries for just different end uses that require softwood, clear softwood lumber.
Like the Home Depot of Cairo.
I guess you could say, but a little bit more than the Home Depot is. It's usually people that are a little bit more technical that have some type of machinery that fits their market.
And you've been using the Export-Import Bank loan guarantee since 2001. Now, to be clear, this is not a loan from the federal government. It's basically a promise to your commercial bank that if you were to default on your line of credit, that the government would then step in and help pay it back. Randy, why do you need this to export lumber?
The reason we do is, well, it just takes the capital to buy the lumber, because we buy the goods from usually small business lumber mills that don't have the staff to export on their own. So we buy from them. And then when we go in and purchase from those mills, you know, we have to pay them. And in the lumber industry, it's pretty standard. A good payer pays within 10 days of shipment.
So here we are. Congress has left the bank, the Export-Import Bank, in limbo by failing to pass this long-term highway bill before the summer recess. Your response to that?
Well, I'm pretty much in disbelief. I've been, you know, talking to my senators and, of course, congressmen, really kind of in disbelief that they let something like this just go and as it is, and they go on summer holiday, so to speak, and haven't had it resolved. Mm.
Your loan guarantee is good through next spring, I believe. But what happens to your business if Congress comes back in the fall and can't get this reauthorized?
Well, if they can't get it reauthorized, you know, mine was renewed in April for 1 year. So I have a little bit of breathing space until then. But after that point, I really don't have a plan. I'd have to look for private investors of some type to see if they could step in, because unless commercial banks change the way they view it. But I don't see that being the case from the banking side.
Some Republicans who are against the Export-Import Bank say that it is a form of corporate welfare, that it's not something that government should be involved in.
Right.
What do you say to that?
Of course, this isn't corporate welfare. You know, I've seen things on the internet where people say a few lucky Americans are able to get XM. That was a quote, a few lucky Americans, and the corporate, the crony capitalism and so forth. Well, I guess I could consider myself as a lucky American, but, you know, we're just a small company, four people, and it's available for all small businesses if they want to pursue it and, you know, have the business credit established, or, you know, some type of track record, that is, in the business that can support a commercial loan. It's open to all small businesses. So I don't really get that that point of a few lucky Americans and that it's picking winners and losers, as some may say.
Randy Barcelo runs BCH Trading, a lumber exporter and a customer of the U.S. Export-Import Bank. Randy, thanks for talking with me.
Sure thing, Peter. I appreciate it.